everyone, and welcome to the British Constitution and Law, episode 36b, King in Parliament. Oakley dokey then, everyone. Last time, we reached Berkeley Castle in the depths of the night, echoing with the screams of Edward II. English history is such a catalogue of love and comfiness, perfect for snuggling up in bed, together with a hottie so that you can drift off gently to the land of Nod. Talking of comfy stories, the constitutional history has brought us to what, in my humble opinion, has to be the greatest story in English royal history, the tale of Edward III. What a story. Love, glory, companionship, daring do, thoroughly reprehensible and yet thoroughly fabulous foreign conquest and glory, tragedy, betrayal, sex and exploitation, and death. It has everything. Where is that miniseries, Auntie? Well, if we were to do a miniseries, you lot, of course, would turn up your collective nose at all that sex and glory stuff, thump firmly on the table, and demand that the series focuses exclusively on the constitutional innovations of the reign and a detailed discussion of the 1352 Treason Act. You'd write letters to your MP in the strongest possible terms, and you would be right to do so. Because, putting aside for a moment all the judicial changes, which I'll do a piece on in a moment, Edward III's reign is a fascinating period for the relationship between monarch and monarched subjects, I mean. There's little doubt to think that Edward deeply resented the way his father was removed and murdered, and he visited his revenge on Mortimer. Lord knows what he'd have done to his mother if he was in a Greek tragedy, eaten her in a leek stew with a naan on the side or something, I guess. But fortunately for Isabella, he wasn't in a Greek tragedy. Nonetheless, he resolutely turned his face away from revenge and towards glory, goaded, it has to be said, by the French, who in the end left Edward very few options for avoiding war, just saying. Edward's strategy, though, had a couple of fundamental requirements. Firstly, his nobility needed to be on his side. After all, England taking on France was like Anthony Nomads taking on Liverpool. At footy, that is. And he needed no trouble back home while he was strutting his stuff in the greatest kingdom of Christendom. Secondly, he needed plenty of the folding stuff. Well, it wasn't folding back then. The clinking, shiny stuff, I mean. Money and lots of it. Sinews of war and all that. And so the reign shows a series of concessions by Edward that had the Victorian historian Stubbsy putting his head in his hands with horror. Nonetheless, the cause of parliamentary government was advanced, with frequent parliaments continuing the process of embedding the principle of consent for taxation. You might be wondering, in fact, I'm sure that you are, about the relative roles of commons and lords. These days we're used to the idea that the commons rules the roost, but all your knowledge of medieval and dark age history will tell you that politics is all about the king and the aristocracy. So how did that play out in Parliament? Well, the first thing to say is that while the expression House of Lords doesn't appear until the 16th century, from Edward III's reign in the 14th, the Parliament was already clearly bicameral. They would start each Parliament in the same place, the Painted Chamber, where King or Archbishop of Canterbury opened proceedings, and then they'd both split off, the Lords going to the White Chamber. Partly, this was led by social superiority, but it also reflected the different standings in other ways. The Lords were called to attend by the King, individually by name, whereas the Commons were elected and representative. On election, they were awarded the right of plena potestas, the power to bind their constituents to the decisions of Parliament, which is an interesting principle, and an important one too. It took until 1461, by the way, for the property qualification for electors to be set. Famously, because it survived for so long, the qualification was set at freeholders with 40 shillings income. It's a sum which at the time included yeomen and even some husbandmen. And with inflation, because the qualification of 40 shillings was fixed, it gradually enlarged the electorate. I say electorate. How often contested elections happened is really very moot. Really, the process has been described as a selection process rather than an election. So most were uncontested and stitched up by major magnates on the basis of Buggins' turn. The franchise in the boroughs, meanwhile, was set by 1430, and once again, the people selected would often be the product of oligarchy rather than what we might see as democracy. So, lords and commons sat separately and carried out their deliberations apart, but they consulted together. Sometimes this was done informally, or more often, a more formal committee to manage business through the house. The general point is that through the 14th and 15th centuries in particular, the House of Lords and Court was where the real politics happened. And in fact, the traditional view used to be that the Commons was entirely subservient to the Lords. These days, the view is not so black and white, actually, and it is clear that the Commons could cut up rough in certain circumstances and expected a positive response to many of their petitions. And certainly, kings spent considerable trouble ensuring that they could control the commons. One of the ways of doing that was to pack the commons with royal servants. So in 1453, an extreme case, 61 of the 278 MPs were actually royal servants. The total number of MPs, by the way, did not include any clergy in the commons, since the church had argued fiercely that they should sit in their own convocation. They would come to regret that decision with the arrival of Henry VIII. In the Lords, numbers, including bishops and abbots, tended to be more than 70, but less than 100. During Edward III's reign, it became accepted that it was the Commons' right to set the level of taxation and give assent to it, and it was a right that they defended hotly. Legislation, though, could come from lords and the king, driven often by petitions that were presented in the commons and responded to through legislation in the lords and from the king. The lords would scrutinise any legislation that came to them from the commons, and they could make unilateral changes, while the commons rarely amended bills that were sent down to them by the lords. However, by the 16th century, it had become reluctantly accepted that wherever the legislation was initiated, it must receive the assent of the commons. And it's rather instructive as to how this came about. So, in 1414, the commons made the assertion, "It has ever been their liberty and freedom that neither statutes nor law so be made, unless they have given assent thereto." Now, historically, this is utter hogwash. And yet, this will be a constant technique that will advance the cause of liberty bit by bit, the appeal to some ancient right, almost exclusively dodgy. The lords used the same technique to establish their right as the High Court of the Kingdom in Richard II's reign, and to insist that a noble of the realm must be tried by his peers in the lords. "It pertained to the Lords of Parliament and to their franchise and liberty of the ancient custom of Parliament to be judges in such a case, and to adjudge such a case with the assent of the king." You see? Appeal to ancient customs, an appeal to maintain and preserve, rather than innovate and change, to restore ancient rights forgotten. And yet, by so doing, innovating and changing. Odd. Essentially, if you're a monarch, your motto must be watch 'em like an orc and don't give 'em an inch, or before you'll know it, they'll have your trousers. Anyway, I guess that counts as a digression because I'm supposed to be talking about Edward III and all that tragedy and all. So by 1376, Edward III was a shadow of his former glorious self. His son and companion in arms, the Black Prince, was dead, as was his wife and muse, Philippa of Hainault. He appears to have been losing his marbles and was seriously under control of the evil mistress Alice Perrers, who, although not being queen, behaved as though she was. She had partners in crime, Latimer the Chamberlain, Lyons the Master of the Royal Mint, who through corruption and control of the king's enfeebled mind controlled the kingdom. There is more than a hint of Theoden and the halls of Edoras about this. But where was Gandalf? The downfall of the baddies was once more the need for money, forcing them to call a parliament. And the mood of the Commons when it arrived was ugly. Speaker after speaker complained that subsidy after subsidy had been misused by the King's ministers and Alice Perrers. From the melee appeared one voice, not of Gandalf, but of one Peter de la Mare, a sheriff, but also a man with the ear of the powerful Earl of March and therefore some protection. Now, as we've said, the Commons were used generally to doing what they were told, but this time they didn't feel like it, not one little bit. So when the Duke of Gaunt, in all his grandeur, came to demand new taxes, their knees would have knocked gently together. Gaunt was every bit the big man, full of contempt for the lowly Commons. Knights of the hedgerow, he called them. Gaunt tried to browbeat the Commons by admitting only their spokesperson, at which point de la Mare stepped forward. The whole Commons had agreed that he should speak for them, and de la Mare faced Gaunt down and insisted that the Commons all be allowed to enter the chamber. We have good records of this Parliament and some of the conversations by which de la Mare faced down Gaunt and took the fight to the King's councillors, Lyons, Latimer and Neville, laying out their corrupt practices. Here, Peter de la Mare uses an approach that emerged only in Edward I's day, when in extremis, Edward allowed himself to provide redress before supply. What that means is, up to that point, the King demanded a subsidy, everyone doffed their caps, bowed and scraped, repeated yes sir several times, and then meekly held out petitions for the King's consideration if he wouldn't mind awfully, but not if it's a bother. Your madge, sir. Providing taxation in times of war was a requirement, in fact. But then on that occasion, and here in the Good Parliament in 1376, the Commons were taking and holding the initiative. You make us happy, pal, and then we'll think about your need to fill your purse and go and make war. So, redress of our grievances and problems before supply of taxation for your wars. Redress then supply, not supply then redress. And that fundamentally changes the power relationship. Desperate for tax in 1376 and divided amongst themselves, the Lords gave way, and the price of the tax was the removal of the King's corrupt ministers and his mistress, Alice Perrers. Now, the process for bringing this lot to trial created a very famous process called impeachment. So, justice was to be served by an indictment initiated against the wrongdoers by the House of Commons, but then to be investigated and judged by the Lords. There is a little confusion about the words. So the OED tells me that the word impeach as an accusation was in use from 1387. But in terms of a legal process, OED uses a quote from 1640. Not sure what's going on here, but this is what we have here in effect, impeachment. Now, the struggle over the King's ministers was effectively, in the long term, also a struggle over who controls the executive, and the accountability of the executive to Parliament. As far as the King was concerned, there was no monkey business going on here at this time. He was the government. He appointed whomever he liked, and don't dare criticise any of my decisions, because you know, I'm God's anointed. In 1376, Parliament took to themselves the right to say no. We obviously don't question your omniscience, sire, but your councillors, they are evil, and they must be removed. Wild. It's worth noting that this startling innovation and shift in practice came on the back of a concession that Edward III had already made in 1341 that ministers should be appointed in Parliament. Thus was the link between Parliament and executive government forged, and an implication that executive government should be accountable to the Commons. Secondly, of course, a new tradition was born, that of Speaker. In de la Mare's case and in the modern Parliament, the Speaker is the representative of the Commons to the Lords and to the Crown. Now, as it happens, in the very next Parliament, the Lords had their revenge. Ministers were reinstated. Peter de la Mare was removed. And until the 17th century, actually, the Speaker becomes more like the King's representative in the Commons. Even Alice Perrers returned to then strip the rings from the fingers of the enfeebled, broken and dying model of chivalry before she legged it. But despite this quick defeat, the genie was once again ex-bottle, as free as the air, on a life trip to Bangor with Steely Span. Impeachment would remain, as would the role of Speaker as Commons representative. The idea had been broached of the accountability of the executive to Parliament. This is a model for so much constitutional change as it happens. You get a big bust-up or a clever manoeuvre, and then vengeance and reversal follows. But nonetheless, a couple of principles have been established and survived through the process. OK, our next destination, ladies and gentlemen, is the 16th century. I had an iTunes review the other day. Lovely review, of course. People are always lovely if they bother to make a review. But making a complaint this time about too much time on a fat, morally ambiguous philanderer. Well, sadly, we'll be going back to the fat, morally ambiguous philanderer for a while, because the reason we all study the Tudors so much is that their reigns defined so much about England. And if at school you thought they were boring, I'm sorry to be aggressive about this, but you might well have not been paying attention. Before we do that, though, let us revisit the law for a few nuggets. First point to make is that the 13th, 14th and 15th century follow a relentless progress towards the professionalisation of the law. We have seen Henry II transplant the stem cells of common law into the bone marrow of the kingdom, and now we hope to see the neutrophils and lymphocytes flourish. This, for me, is a topical metaphor. If I ever listen again, it will remind me. Shall we have a quick reminder of what the common law is then? Much of what you will hear about law comes from a book by the child that lived, Harry Potter, in his book Law, Liberty and the Constitution. Like many people, Harry loves the common law and gets very passionate about it. Not being a lawyer, it's slightly difficult to know whether this is hyperbole or has any truth to it. But Harry writes this: England's common law, however imperfectly, ensures justice and liberty, and in that respect equals anything the English have achieved in the arts and sciences. Now look, I am a lowly historical storyteller, ex-publisher and purveyor of fine educational assessments, so what do I know of this claim? I do know that people get very teary-eyed about the common law. I have no idea if in other jurisdictions people get so enthusiastic about their law. However, it does at very least have its own history and characteristic. It owes relatively little to Roman or to continental systems because, as we've heard, the Normans brought almost no law with them. And the Roman civilization of England was rather wiped out by those naughty Anglo-Saxons. Civil law, the most commonly used system of law among Western countries, is based on Roman law, which dates back to the laws of Justinian in 600. They're obviously amended in each system since then, and Roman law is codified. Common law, on the other hand, relies on precedents, judgments made in similar cases or from judicial opinion on specific matters, as well as from statute law, that is, law made in Parliament. It includes the concept of equity, the ability for judges to apply justice in line with something reassuringly vague called natural law. Now, as I say, I am not a lawyer, and I expect a chorus of complaints from this description, but I'm going to have a hack at describing why folks wax so lyrical about common law. Here we go. The reason seems on the one hand to be flexibility. The interpretation of case law and the use of principles of equity allows judges plenty of leeway in making judgment. Another is that it is organic. Common law has evolved from customary law over a long, long time. It has grown up with us and changed and adapted to circumstances. There's an assumed love of tradition here, I guess, so you may disagree with the idea that it accommodates the wisdom of the ages, that sort of thing. And then there's the participation thing, the inclusion in the process of the local community. So in juries, for example, once in a wider sense even more than now, since there used to be grand jurors to identify crimes and petty jurors to make verdicts on individual cases. Well, so there we go. Apparently, about 150 countries have systems based on Roman law and about 80 on common law. But I have read quite a lot suggesting that most systems these days do have elements of both. Why common law then? Does it pick its teeth in public? Or do Moonies have the coach carrying Roman law to the game? Not quite, but close. We're going to hear about Glanville in a minute, the jurist who wrote in the 12th century that common law meant the settled law of the king's court, common to all free men, in the sense that it is available to them in civil cases, if they will have it, and applicable against them in serious criminal causes, whether they like it or not. We've seen that Henry II laid the stem cells of common law, though it's maybe important also to point out that the origin lies even further back, to some degree, in the customary laws and codes of Anglo-Saxon England. But I am told that it is the legal profession that really put the flesh on the bones created by the Crown. I was told that by a lawyer, as it happens, oddly. Well, the Crown steadily professionalises the legal infrastructure and makes that infrastructure permanent and stationary and gives them a home rather than having to follow the king around on his travels. First up, as a permanent court, was the Court of the Exchequer. You will all know by now that the Exchequer was so named from the checkerboard used to help keep account of the sheriff's returns. The court was initially at least there to deal with financial disputes of the Crown. And then one fine day, loud groans were heard from the Exchequer Court, along with the odd, "Get that idiot out of here!" And with a scream and a slap, a new court was born. The Court of Common Pleas, not to be confused with the Court of Garden Peas. And this was the main royal court, the Court of Common Pleas, rather than anything to do with garden peas, which is a really weak joke. I do apologise. The Court of Common Pleas was then followed by the Court of the King's Bench, sometime after 1230, which court had the power to review judgments of the Court of Common Pleas, though with no jurisdiction over garden peas. I'm going to drop that joke now. Then there's the Court of Chancery, around 1400, a court of equity drawn from the King's Council, its authority drawn from the royal prerogative. Its name comes from the cancelli, or wooden screen, behind which its clerks worked. That is a fab fact for you to drop next time that you're trying to pick someone up by showing your erudition, which, as I'm told, a great way to chat people up. What is a court of equity, I hear you ask? Well, again, these are cases where judges had the right to come to a decision based not on precedence, but on some notion of natural justice. They were popular, giving quick results until the king started to use them as an easy way to get what he wanted. However, equity courts had no jurisdiction over cases like rape or murder. Then the Court of Star Chamber was established in 1348, another equity court of the King's Council, and so known for its ceiling decorated with gold stars. Amazingly, said ceiling still exists. It was brought by a hotel in the northwest. Good golly, Miss Molly. And then finally, the Court of Requests was another equity court for people that could not afford to go to law. All of these courts were crammed into Westminster Hall, each with their own little corner. What a racket there must have been. And surely, as barnacles grow on boats, commerce joined the game too, with lots of pop-up shops selling books and legal kit. And meanwhile, there's a load of blokes just lounging around doing their very best not to look suspicious, and they had bits of straw sticking out of their shoes. These were the so-called men of straw, and the straw indicated that their testimony could be bought. It is not the origin, by the way, of the word straw man. Well, I was saying that some lawyers had drawn me aside and let me know that lawyers were responsible for the common law, and I guess the point is that a strong and expert legal profession grew up, and the existence of permanent, well-trained professional judges was essential to making decisions over competing precedences and custom and creating one effective body of the best common law. There is as yet no advocacy in courts, nothing like the system of advocates that you might be used to from the telly, like QC or Silk or Crown Court for the longer in the tooth. But the increasing complexity meant clients and judges needed counsellors. They needed help in court to get things right. So the first to emerge were the so-called narratores, who were given access to courts to enter the plaintiff's plea in a clear and effective manner. They organised themselves into fraternities that were called sergeants at law. The growing demand for well-trained lawyers gradually generated four inns of court that grew up after the middle of the 14th century around Holborn in London. The point about these lawyers, therefore, defending and growing common law was that they were trained here in the Inns of Court in what together effectively constituted a third university. They were educated here in the ins and outs of common law, not in civil and canon law. Those were taught at Oxford and Cambridge universities. And with this conveyor belt of expertise from the Inns of Court in common law, the law was revised and updated and adapted through case law. Statute law at this point was still a tiny part of the mix. The growing complexity and extent and professionalisation of common law led to the creation of manuals to make some attempt to bring a clearer understanding of the underlying principles and a corpus of case law to train the new professionals in. After the 12th century, Glanville on the Laws and Constitutions of England was created by a judge and completed by his clerk, after whom it was named Bracton. The profession began a process of producing yearbooks, and so the corpus of and access to case law grew, out of which would grow the idea that these precedents were legally binding, though not until the 19th century was that really embedded. In medieval common law, judgments were often not written down in detail or reasons for the judgments given. But with written yearbooks, the judges and sergeants at law were better able to bring together the various cases and develop judgments based on those precedents. The author of Bracton had been trained in Roman and civil law, and part of his intention in what he did flowed from that codification that underlay Roman law. But in Roman law, the king's will was law, and indeed many monarchs in England would continue to show that aspiration that the monarch was above the law. But increasingly, the legal profession in England just didn't agree with them. So in Bracton appears the idea that sure, the king has no equal, he is instead under God and under law, because law makes the king. For there is no king where will rules rather than law. In the 15th century, we get another of those famous codifiers of English law, Sir John Fortescue, who wrote In Praise of the Laws of England, and therefore also started a brave and long English tradition of telling everyone what a great legal system we have here, presumably followed by a statement of how many hours would be billed as a result. Sorry, that was a cheap shot. Fortescue also started another tradition by laying claim to the deep antiquity of the common law, predating the Roman invasion, he claimed. This would be an important tradition because it allowed the assertion of the primacy of law. And Fortescue joined in with the venerable tradition of goading the French as well. He contrasted the French royal governance, where the king's will was law and he governed without consent, to the English political and regal government, which meant that common assent was required to all law. The Roman concept that what pleases the prince has force of law, claimed Fortescue, was alien to the English system, where law derived from the consent of the people who had submitted of their own will to the government of the people. here then is one of those principles so important to the arrival at a modern constitution, the recognition that the people are sovereign. However, this was the 15th century, and as you may know, there'll be a deal of arguing back from monarchs before they sulkily accept this fundamental truth. While we're on Fortescue, he also was the first to record what would become a grand series of declarations by great, if slightly pompous, legal writers of the Enlightenment, like William Blackstone and Voltaire. One would much rather that 20 guilty persons should escape the punishment of death than that one innocent person should be condemned and suffer capitally. Well, you heard it first in the 15th century. Although he's also attributed with the phrase, comparisons are odious, actually, which I always thought was John Lydgate, also in the 15th century. All of which goes to prove that there's nothing new under the sun, Ecclesiastes 1:9. Fortescue also made the point that unlike in France, no one could be condemned on the strength of confessions extracted by torture. It's worth noting that the lad was in exile in France at this time, and I would imagine the French might be thinking he was abusing their hospitality. But maybe this is the right place to discuss torture. What do you think? Or is this podcast torture enough for you? Very quickly then. Torture was not a standard part of the judicial process in England, where after the Lateran Council of 1215 and the withdrawal of the God Squad from the legal process, the jury system developed, and it was the jury that was required instead to judge on the truth or otherwise of the accusations, rather than God. Roman law relied on an inquisitorial system where, in order to gain sufficient evidence, torture was admissible to gain a confession from the accused. Not only visited on the accused, it must be said, but also on witnesses, where the inquisitor felt they were holding out. The truth must be established, or seen to be established, whereas common law, through the jury system, gave much greater leeway. In 1252, torture was also authorised by the Pope for use by the church inquisitions. Evidence discovered under torture was dismissed as unreliable in common law. In addition, it contravened a basic principle. It's all explained by Francis Bacon. By the law of England, no man is bound to accuse himself. In the highest cases of treason, torture is used for discovery and not for evidence. What Bacon points to then is that torture was used for discovery, not for evidence, by which he means that torture was used to discover accomplices in key cases. So that is not to say that torture was never used in England. It could be used in capital cases and derived from the royal prerogative, and therefore it could be authorised by the king or his council. So, for example, torture was used on the Jesuit John Gerard in Elizabeth's reign to try to make him reveal other Catholic priests, which he resisted with stunning courage. In fact, there are 81 warrants that survive for the period between 1540 and 1640 in England, and accounting for a few losses, that's probably about one a year. Its use was not evenly distributed, though. Elizabeth was by far the worst offender, frequently setting her corgis on people she didn't like. Sorry, rubbish joking again. Elizabeth I was the worst offender, as she and her Privy Council rather panicked with the flood of priests coming from the continent to try to save Catholicism in England and support the faithful. James VI and I authorised it but six times, and that great tyrant Charles I only twice. The last two people to be tortured were a pair of London apprentices who led a march in London in 1640. Let me tell you, if every apprentice who caused trouble had been tortured, then England would have been right at the top of the league table of torture, not down in the relegation zone. Anyway, Charles felt he had to be seen to be doing something, so William Archer was racked to reveal fellow conspirators. The lad knew nothing, so it was as brutal as it was useless. On the advice of the far from merciful Thomas Wentworth, Earl of Strafford, Thomas Benstead and William Archer were then hung, drawn and quartered. If it comes up at a rather grisly pub quiz then, the last person to be a victim of authorised torture in England was William Archer in 1640. In this case then, the vagaries of common law had a humane impact. Hooray for common law! But in another, it had a less than humane impact. Boo for common law. The rules required that a plea be entered. If the defendant refused to do so, they were subjected to pain fort et dur. This meant they had heavy stones loaded on them until they either entered a plea or died. Why, I hear you say, why would he refuse to plea? Well, only someone convicted at trial could have all their estates confiscated. So the brave souls who refused to plead at least died in the knowledge that their families would not starve after they'd gone. Pain fort et dur was a feature of English justice from 1275 to 1772, when a conviction in 1772 was substituted for no plea. In 1827, this was replaced by a plea of not guilty imposed for those refusing to plead. The wheel of justice turns slowly, but it turns. You really need to stop me talking, but just before we finally hop off to the turgid Tudors, as I promised ages ago, there is one, just one last thing to do, and that is to mention the Justices of the Peace, a role that really comes into its own now. Now, Harry Potter appears to have delivered the Avada Kedavra curse on this topic, so I should now mention J.H. Baker's Introduction to English Legal History. It is a great book if you want more detail, but I'd advise a stiff drink before you open it. J.P.'s, Justices of the Peace, originated around the end of Richard I's reign. That's Richard, yay or nay, the great Coeur de Lion to you. Two knights of the Shire were appointed to keep the peace. By the 14th century, the older structures of justice, the shire and county courts, the sheriffs, had come to be rather tatty around the edges, like a mouse nibbled cheese. Many of the hundred courts were in the pockets of the local magnates. The role of the once mighty sheriffs had been supplanted by either magnates with franchised rights or by royal commissions. There was a very real danger that England would become like a collection of regional satrapies. The Justice of the Peace did much to hold that in check, as during Edward III's reign, a series of statutes extended their role. Their job was at once judicial, to hold the quarter sessions of the hundred courts, which dealt with all pleas not reserved to the crown, and the quarter sessions, which would survive until 1971, doing more important cases. And it also included administrative functions, such as provision for the poor and orphans of the parish, maintenance of highways, and a myriad of local government tasks. So the JPs became the principal check on regional power, acting on behalf of the crown, since their authority rested on a royal commission, and therefore their relationship was directly with the crown, rather than being dependent on the local magnate. Bracton described the people who took up the role of JP as buzones, an odd word, meaning sort of a big man. Often they'd have local authority enough to resist the local magnate, they'd probably attend Parliament too, and so they were directly connected to the centre. The JP will be at the centre of English judicial systems for centuries. Okay, that's it. Promise. Off to the testy Tudors at last. Now, if I had a nip of scotch for every complaint on Twitter that we just went on and on about the Tudors, no one ever taught me about traditional basket weaving in Eastern Hungary, our education is a disgrace, I would have a serious liver problem. The point is that it's not about Henry. It's about the absolute centrality of the Tudor period for the rest of English history. Politics, religion, culture, national awareness, naval development, exploration, and constitution. Just to paraphrase Beefy Botham, or Lord Botham, as I should call him now, I guess, you need to spend less time watching the waistline and more time watching the cricket, or history in this case. Is that a good metaphor? Not sure. Anyway, it's the same for the Constitution, but I will be brief because I am indeed conscious of having made a meal of this in the history of England. Before I do, let me mention again the Courts of Equity, Chancery, Requests and Star Chamber, which I mentioned earlier. Since it's during Tudor times, under the auspices of famous names like Thomas Wolsey and Thomas More, that equity courts begin to acquire greater prominence. One of the problems with common law was becoming to be that as it professionalised, it became more complex and more expensive and slow, and it became a bit rigid too. So making judgment according to the law became preferable to delivering justice in the mind of judges, because it gave judges a problem. How did they make judgments according to their perception of justice? Or was it the letter of law that should be applied, irrespective of whether it seemed right or not? I mean, now, for a judge, this was a major issue. And again, another great argument for jurors, because effectively it became the jury's job to decide what was justice. Judges began to instruct them to produce verdicts according to their conscience. Thus, judges were saved from a difficult Morton's fork of unpalatable choices. There was another solution to the problem, though, and to the problem of complexity. The way out of it was through the ancient right of recourse to the king as the font of all justice. As the number of petitions grew asking for the king to intervene, the king delegated this power to judge according to his conscience down the org chart to the Lord Chancellor. Successive chancellors worked out rules for equity courts, which included written depositions, a sort of inquisitorial approach rather than using juries. Equity courts were quick and they sought to deliver fairness. Now, I don't know about you, but the phrase Star Chamber strikes fear into my heart. A symbol of tyranny from which the brave parliamentarians like Pym and Hampden and radicals like Lilburn saved us all to live in peace and harmony, cry Harry, and all that. Although, joking apart, when I was in gainful employment, we had an end-of-project review for all projects. The boss jokingly called it the Star Chamber. How we laughed. Anyway, yes, Star Chamber has that connotation of tyranny, but it didn't in the 15th and 16th centuries. People rather liked it. Quick justice that sought fairness, what's not to like? The trouble is that the judgments could be utterly arbitrary, taking no notice of accepted law. And so if a tyrant came along looking to use the freedom of equity to put away his political enemies, well, there would be trouble. OK, so back to the politics and constitutional stuff then, and we are talking about how lucky you all were to do 16 solid years of the Tudors at school with your heads held under the tap if your attention wavered for an instant. The reign of the Tudors, first of all, transformed in 1542 the legal position of Wales, bringing it into the same legal and administrative structure as England, with representation in Parliament. The law was to be administered in English. Franchises such as the Welsh and Northern Marches were either removed or weakened, greatly extending the reach and standardisation of central authority. Thus, the nation-state began to form under the Tudors. Religious changes now, the Act of Supremacy. Apart from the fact that the monarch was now the head of the church, changed to governor of the church under Elizabeth, suddenly Parliament's competence now included religion. Well, there's a thing. And no longer was there a foreign power in the Pope who could interfere in English governance or be appealed to by English subjects. So that's a major constitutional change. During the reign, despite the Statute of Proclamations, it became established that statute law was supreme over judge-made law, and indeed over royal proclamation. And therefore, it was also established that one statute could only be repealed by another statute in Parliament. The king couldn't just proclaim it out of the way. So there's a thing. There's a restriction on royal power. And then there's this from Henry VIII, often lazily referred to as a tyrant. We be informed by our judges that we at no time stand so highly in our estate royal as in the time of Parliament. Golly. So here we are then at a central concept of the British Constitution, then as now. At its basis is a mix of Crown and Parliament. It seems invisible to us now. Parliament is surely supreme, and it is, though more of that in a future episode, but its authority is still based on a combination of royal authority and the liberty and rights of the people as represented in Parliament. So, the King in Parliament, the monarch in Parliament, is the basis of the British Constitution. I have one more point to make about the English Long Reformation, so throughout the Tudor period, including Elizabeth I. It made religion, and particularly anti-Catholic fears, a core part of British politics for the next 150 years or more, although the principle of toleration, in terms of private practice of religion, was effectively sorted earlier. But it also did something else. Among all the toings and froings, intolerance, anger, fury, accusations, the Reformation in Elizabethan times became a genuine national conversation in which people at all levels of society and walks of life were involved. Conformists, traditionalists, fiercely Catholic, Puritans, many different flavours. The right of English people to interpret the Bible as they saw fit would flower in the 17th century in particular, but maybe the death of the potential for uniformity, surely clear by 1600, promoted a sense of a public right to debate and a voice for all. I busk, but it's a thought. Well, that's enough to convince you about the Tudors, surely. At heart of all that is the idea that Parliament grew enormously in power, despite the froth at the top of all the Tudor glory and even tyranny, you might call it. The role of Parliament grew enormously. Anyway, for once I have managed to deal succinctly with a big subject, namely the Tudors. So we've done 3 centuries now, well done me. But don't worry, this won't happen again. Next time then, in British Constitution C, revolutions will maybe deal with various revolutions, glorious or otherwise, and bring us to the threshold of modernity. I shall look forward to it. Thank you for listening, everyone. Thank you so much for being members. Good luck and have a great fortnight.